Hello, fan club. First, I wanted to say something. It's not in the talk. This is the talk. But I wanted to address the reading that Paramabandhu did, which was very interesting to me because I've been reading this book called How to Live Forever and Die Trying by Brian Appleyard. And before I came out, I was reading this section about mortality and life expectancy, and that in the hunter-gatherer era, life expectancy of human beings was 18 years. In the Middle Ages, it was 33 years. In the Industrial Revolution, it was like 40 years. Now it's something like 75 years. So, and there's a movement of people that are trying to get us to live forever. You know, there's a lot of money in America going into trying to find out a way of us not having to die at all. But what was interesting to me about the reading was that he's talking about our genes and our DNA, and that nature is programmed in the wild to die young and to die at the point of reproductive activity, of just to reproduce oneself, and that that wild animals don't die old. You know, only household pets die old, and people in civilized circumstances die old. So it seems as if fear is programmed into our genes, because the Buddha had a very happy childhood. You know, but yet, from the reading that you did, he was having to cope with fear, you know, on a very primitive level. So it's as if fear is very much a basic part of our makeup. So I just thought that was interesting. So I'll carry on with the prepared script. Okay. I'd like to thank everyone with whom I've had conversations about fear and fearlessness, and I hope I've incorporated people's ideas. So thanks to all of you, who you know who you are. So this theme connects with the green Buddha, Amoghasiddhi, who you've heard a lot about, and his right hand is held up in what's called the Abhaya Mudra. That's a reassuring hand gesture that says, don't be afraid. And in his left hand, at this place called the Tantien, is it? This Chinese point that's very vital to our life force or something. So this is Amoghasiddhi's posture. Now this, the double vajra, is the most powerful, as Paramabandhu had said, the vajra is the most powerful thing in the universe. Well, this is a double vajra. Well, that's even more powerful, or twice as powerful. But it also represents total psychic integration. So the Buddha, Amoghasiddhi, is both poised and centered, while at the same time reassuring and outgoing. And all the Buddhas convert different poisons to different wisdoms. Well, Amoghasiddhi converts the poisons of envy, jealousy, and fear into unobstructed success, or all-accomplishing wisdom. He represents to me the Buddha's effective actions in the world, which stem from limitless compassion and wisdom and fully integrated energy. I'll put my energy down for a moment. I've taken on this practice because I wish to become more and more effective in the world, to make my existence matter, while paradoxically seeking to be less and less identified with an ego or any particular outcome. The obstacle to effective action is fear, and this fear, as I said before, includes envy and jealousy, which are byproducts of fear. When we are envious, we believe that if we had or were what someone else has or is, we would be safe and lovable, safe and lovable in the world. Therefore, we feel lacking in what we believe we need to be safe in the world. Whereas jealousy is the fear of losing what we believe we have that keeps us safe in the world, that'll be taken away from us by someone else. So they're both two sides of the same coin. So both envy and jealousy are poisons based on our self-view of lack. And when we develop more self-metta, we realize that we're all in the same boat, and we experience our interconnectedness, rejoice in others' good fortune rather than being envious of it, and we have more courage to take risks. Taking risks is a necessary stance when being on a spiritual path, so that we move out of our comfort zone or our discomfort zone in order to grow and develop and realize our full potential. So I'm going to talk about the path from fear to fearlessness with illustrations from my own life. And also I'd like to set the scene in how I see the social and economic circumstances in which we exist in our postmodern world. For years, this line has been in my mind, and thanks to Google, I found the source of it. And it's from A.E. Housman, and the line is, "I am a stranger and afraid in a world I never made." So I identify this line as I think it describes our existential condition. When we're born into a world already set up when we get here, and it has complex values and strategies which we have to learn to negotiate the world, and we are fundamentally on our own. We can be helped or hindered by family and friends, but the individuation process is our own. We are essentially alone when we're born and alone when we die. In between, we face the challenges of developing our potential. We are each a unique combination of genetic material, particular conditioning, perhaps astrological placement, karmic heritage, whatever, but each one of us is quite unique. And I feel we're duty-bound to develop and express this uniqueness. But paradoxically, as we embark on a spiritual path, we let go more and more of our self-identity or ego and feel increasingly interconnected with all living beings. The Buddha, in all his manifestations, represents the highest attainment of our goals of full integration of energies, unbounded wisdom, and compassionate action characterized by fearlessness. Our teacher Sangharachitta lists a hierarchy of things that we can give when we exercise the perfection of generosity, and fearlessness is high up on the list, well above material gifts that we can give. Okay. Now, giving the gift of fearlessness in today's world is particularly beneficial, as we're fed almost a constant diet of alarmist news and entertainment. We're warned of health scares, terrorism, youth on the rampage, violence, global warming on a, you know, in a hysterical way. I mean, I don't want to minimize the issue of global warming, but I think the way that it's presented, at least my reaction, is one feeling totally impotent. It's just so overwhelming. And so it's paralyzing. And I see like generating fear, keeping a drip level of fear going in populations is a way of controlling people. Because when we're afraid, I'll tell you what we'll do when we're afraid. When we're afraid, we try to insulate ourselves from this terrifying world. as if we can live in a bubble surrounded by material acquisitions so that we need not face the reality of the truth of our mundane existence and of all existence characterized by impermanence, superficiality, and meaninglessness. We hide from the real fears of old age, sickness, and death. Exposure to which to these things, old age, sickness, and death, is what started the Buddha on his path. It's ironic that at the same time that we're fed with this constant diet of fear-making communications from the media, we're also more and more insulated from real danger by the never-ending health and safety regulations designed not so much to protect us as to watch the backs of those who can become subject of litigation. The German philosopher, I'll get to my life in a minute. First I have to do the heavy stuff. Okay. What Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, taught is that we have to face our own mortality to become authentic individuals. And it becomes more and more difficult when death itself is hidden from us in the modern world. I spoke about Brian Appleyard's book, How to Live Forever. I was just talking about it at the beginning of the talk. And one of the points he makes is that far from wanting to really live forever, impermanence is what contributes to our civilization. You know, that we love things that are impermanent. We love flowers that die rather than plastic replica flowers. We love sunsets that fade. We love sunrises. We even love loss in relationships. You know, there's a sort of bittersweetness in love and loss that forms the basis of poetry and song. And without, you know, if we think of everything sort of fixed and we're going to live forever and nothing's going to change, it's like a nightmare scenario. That it's very depressing reading, thinking of all the resources going in to try to make this happen with cryogenics, people being, you've probably heard of that, people being frozen at the point of death so that in some future time when there's a cure for their illness, they'll be brought back to life. I mean, who wants a world populated by these people, you know? You know. All right. Okay, fear is paradoxical, that it's not necessarily harmful, and some people enjoy a level of fear, that fear stimulates the adrenaline system and prepares the body for fight or flight. Children tend to like scary stories and take risks that their parents dare not know about. I know I did in childhood. However, there is less opportunity to be really frightened in one's life as we are more and more insulated from any possible dangers. Children are driven to school, city streets are so full of traffic that kids can't play outdoors as I had when I was a child in Brooklyn. Many people enjoy scary movies, scary fun fair rides, and a certain amount of fear is necessary to maximize one's performance, particularly stage fright. You know, me, for instance, you know, being a bit nervous has somehow mobilized my energies in giving this talk, whereas if I was like, you know, all laid back, you know, it might be a bit boring and unfocused. Okay, so now's the personal bit. So I've been thinking a long time about this talk, and one morning I thought to myself, I'm going to make an inventory of all those things that I'm afraid of. So I'm going to make an inventory of the things that I'm still afraid of, things I have been afraid of, things that I've made some inroads into being less afraid of, and see what I come up with. And what I realized I was a bit ashamed of some of the things I had on this list, because probably people here would say, she's afraid of that, that's a doddle. You know, there's nothing to be afraid of that. So I realized that fear is quite idiosyncratic. We all have our own fear. And, you know, the book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, you know, so there's no virtue in being brave in any particular external way. You know, for each of us, there's our own things that we're afraid of, you know, and making inroads to those things, no matter how small, is courage. All right. Okay, so this is the deepest thing for me. A strong fear that has kept me from going deeper into my meditation is an underlying sense of terror. And the terror has been experienced early on in meditation as a sensation of falling into an endless abyss, sliding down and down endlessly in a dark chute with no end. However, I'm proud to report that recently I went to the Tate Modern with a friend, and I queued up to go down one of Carsten Holler's chutes, and everybody seemed to be enjoying themselves. Kids were screaming and old people, and everybody was having a wonderful time. And when my turn came, I looked into this pit, and I felt, I can't do it. I can't do it. It just was so reminiscent of this kind of fear that I was talking about. And then I remembered that I had to give this talk, you know, soon. So how could I not do it? So I just got in this white sack thing and put these guards on my elbows, and I don't know what else I did, but, oh, yes, that's right. You had to be in a corpse position, watching, you know. And so I slid down, and it was terrible. But, you know, I didn't enjoy it, but I felt so proud that at least I did it. You know, so that was one thing that I've overcome that probably most people wouldn't be frightened of. Okay, so here are some more fears of mine that I've made some inroads into, or else I've set up conditions where I had to do them, whether I was afraid or not. Okay, and one, which I'll confess, was being very anxious about being on the team of the winter retreat at Sickford. And if I hadn't promised to go, I would have backed out. But as it turned out, I had a very good time. It was very beneficial. I mean, there were some problems for me, but it turned out to be a really, really good experience. So I'm glad I did that. All right, another fear is I've been afraid of driving. And at the age of 40, I finally, after many failures, I passed my driving test. I think meditation helped me do that. I mean, at one point, I tried Valium on one of the tests. And you know, you have the emergency stop, you know, where they bang. Oh, that's okay. They bang on the dashboard for the emergency stop, and I didn't even hear it. You know? So I failed that one. But then meditation, I think, was the thing that got me through. Anyway, so even though I was afraid, I'd load up my little Beetle and go off to the countryside somewhere and go on a solitary retreat, which I used to do quite a lot when I had a car, which I don't anymore. Okay, in childhood, I finally, much later than any of the other kids on my block, learned to ride a bicycle. But I was always afraid to negotiate traffic, so I never properly cycled, you know, like as most people here probably do. I'm still afraid of drowning, which prevents me from learning to swim properly and go in over my head. I'm afraid of getting lost and being in a strange environment. Although once I'm there, I enjoy the exploration, but there's always a sense of anxiety in leaving my flat. I'm afraid of being broke and dependent for money. And that's a legacy from growing up in the unforgiving culture of America and the highly competitive and brutal culture, especially of New York. and I'm afraid of strong wind. In fact, in these gales, I live on the 10th floor, and I could feel the block swaying, and it felt like I was on a palm tree in the monsoon somewhere, you know. If that's the right metaphor, I don't know. Okay, so this is what I'm not afraid of, that other people may be afraid of. I'm not afraid of groups of teenagers, hooded or not. I'm really not afraid of talking to a large group of people, which probably some of you are. I'm not afraid of lifts. I'm not afraid of height. I'm not afraid of flying. I'm not afraid of spiders. I'm not afraid of snakes. I'm a little afraid of mice, though. And I'm no longer afraid of computers, because I did a computer maintenance course, and now I'm no longer afraid of computers. I'm no longer afraid of going mad. And I'm no longer afraid of farting in earshot of others, which helps when one is on a vegetarian diet. I'm less afraid, excuse me, I'm less afraid of crying in public, although I hardly ever do. I'm not afraid of confronting people in positions of power, as I did as a social worker and in other situations. I overcame my terror of being naked in front of other people by modeling for art classes. And when I was a kid in summer camp, the counselors wrote to my parents to say that I was really dirty and smelly because I was too afraid to use the communal showers. So I never showered the whole summer. I'm no longer afraid of the dark, because when I did one of these solitary retreats, I encouraged myself to go into the woods at night by myself, sit next to a stream under a tree and do a puja, you know, which I seem to remember by heart. You know, I couldn't see the text. So I was quite proud of that. So I'm no longer afraid of the dark. I'm less afraid of showing my artwork in public, and I'm less afraid of declaring myself a Buddhist in public and exposing my deepest held beliefs and feelings. Of course, as I get older, more fears emerge that are age-relevant, like fear of dependency, lessening of the faculties of vision and hearing. And the upside is that with age, things take on a different importance, as I'm no longer afraid of being alone and without a relationship, as has been the case for most of my life. I've always been afraid of not being in a relationship for most of my life, so I've always been in a relationship for most of my life, you know, which didn't make for very good relationships. If they're based on just wanting a relationship, doesn't matter. Okay. Now, my mother will be 98 in 2 months. I hope she lives for 2 months more, because I plan to see her. Last time I visited her in New York, I thought would be the last time I'd see her. She seemed to be in the throes of death. She was breathing shallowly and laboriously. And as I was saying goodbye to her in my heart, she woke up, looked at me and said, Oh, hello, you're here. So, and more than a year later, she's still around, and I believe that she's afraid to die. She's afraid to let go. Like years ago, I remember her wishing that she were dead so that she could see her mother and sisters in heaven. And this reminds me of a story that Sangha Ratchet told. I think it's a Tibetan story about a very religious old lady who daily worships in a monastery in front of a Buddha statue. And part of her prayer is to say, "Oh Buddha, oh Lord Buddha, please take me, please take me." And the monk or the abbot who was in charge of the monastery was really she was getting on his nerves because every day she'd say the same thing. So one day she hid behind the Buddha. I mean, he hid behind the Buddha, and she said, oh, Lord Buddha, please take me, please take me. And then the monk behind the Buddha said, okay, I'm taking you now. And she said, oh, no, not yet, not yet. And she ran away. So that's sort of like my mother. Excuse me. That's sort of like my mother wishing she could see her sisters and her mother in heaven. But not yet. Now, my grandparents, I mean, I've inherited from a lineage of fear-making people, or I don't know how to put it. I'll put it the way I have it here. My grandparents were fearful. My mother was fearful. And as I say, she still is fearful of living, fearful of dying, caught in a no-man's land. And consequently, I was a fearful child, though often compensated by seeming quite foolhardy and independent. But underneath, I was quite frightened. My grandparents were immigrants from persecution in Eastern Europe, and it's understandable that they should feel unsafe in the world. But it's almost as if a mechanism was handed down through the generations that perceived danger and threats in an exaggerated way. I mean, my upbringing was, oh, don't, oh, don't. You know, those were the kind of sounds that I remember of, you know, of Mananda's laughing. You recognize it? Yeah, he has a similar background. They're not American. Okay, now, what I'm going to talk about now is, I said the useful components of fear, but what I'm going to talk about is how fear is a hindrance to spiritual practice. And I think what illustrates the point that I want to make is illustrated by the title of a film by Fassbinder, a German film director who made this film in 1974, and it's called Fear Eats the Soul. And I thought it was like just such a good title of a film. And it's about, I mean, the story itself isn't that relevant to this talk, but what it's about is racial prejudice that corrodes a relationship from within. And I think that most social ills can be boiled down to fear. Because when we're afraid, we're closed, we're not open, we're hard, we're not soft and vulnerable, we're tight, we're not expansive, we're rigid, we're not flexible, we're contracted, we're not expansive, and we're tense, we're not relaxed, and we're ugly. When we're fearful, we're not beautiful. When we're fearful, fear doesn't look like it's not a beautiful expression, is it? And when people are afraid, hate prevails over love, defensiveness prevails over openness, and cruelty prevails over kindness. Superstition prevails over rationality, reactivity prevails over creativity. Impulsiveness prevails over mindfulness. Greed is encouraged by advertising to fortify us against unnamed and named threats, such as our appearance, our safety, or to put it in general dharmic terms, to insulate us against old age, sickness, and death. Hatred in many forms is rife against the unfamiliar and the unknown, spawning distrust of our neighbors and chipping away at our civil liberties and freedoms through omnipresent surveillance. And racism and social prejudice of all kinds prevails. Spiritual ignorance underlies all this, which is experienced as anxiety and confusion, causing widespread social problems of depression, ill health, mental and physical addiction, and lack of self-confidence. And all these states are anathema to spiritual practice. That is why it is said that our goals aren't so much enlightenment, but to become happy, healthy, and human. This is what we're aiming towards, and from that is the jumping off point to higher spiritual states. And I think I am still working on becoming more happy, healthy, and human. On the winter retreat at Sitford, someone in my group made an interesting comment. I'm glad he's not here, so he won't be embarrassed. But he said at the end of the retreat, he said, "Oh, isn't it a shame that we're all dispersing? Such nice people come on retreat, and wouldn't it be great if we could all stay together and start a community together and all live together forever," kind of thing. And I thought about what he said, and I thought, no, the people who come on retreat aren't very nice when they first arrive. You know, I didn't find them very nice. What kind of room is this? Do you have another pillow? You know, like people are not nice when they come on retreat, usually. But in just a couple of days, people become very nice. And I think that what happens to people on retreat is the fear goes. And when fear goes, the natural niceness is released, so that people are very nice at the end of a retreat. I don't know if people disagree with this, but that certainly has been my experience over 5 years of being on the team at Sitford. And that made me think that if we could each of us go out and scoop up 100 people, as about the number of people that are on the retreat, create a harmonious, safe environment, you know, with meditation and spiritual practice, then you'd have another 100 people that are nice, you know, and we could just spread the sangha that way, you know, creating all these niceness environments. You know, one by one the sangha grows, or 100 by 100 the sangha grows. So what are we really afraid of, you know, in a spiritual sense? You know, I talked about being wired up physiologically in relation to fear, but what does our mind think that we're afraid of? And the overall category of what we fear is the unknown, or non-existence. Losing those qualities, components, people, things by which we define ourselves as we are, our self-view. The more constricted, the more narrow our self-view, the greater the barriers we erect in our communication with others, and the more fearful we are. It's as if we create the conditions to increase our fearfulness when we think we are protecting ourselves. The wider, more fluid, more inclusive our self-definition, the less afraid we become. We are always more than we think we are, and we're always less than we think we are. As Banti has put it, we are all better than we think we are, but we're all so much worse than we think we are. We fear losing what we think comprise ourselves, those people, those views, those possessions, those mannerisms, those aspects of our familiar world which comprise our identity. Therefore, the spiritual life can seem initially quite frightening because it encourages redefinition of ourselves in a trajectory towards ultimate egolessness, whereby we cease to identify ourselves with anything in particular. We don't identify with any views, any particular activities, any places, any people, possessions, or even with Buddhism itself, and we hang loose to life. We don't prejudge any person or situation, but we're open to respond creatively to each situation as it presents itself to us. This is what Amoghas City brings with his all-accomplishing wisdom. All right. So, as Dhamma Dawson said, at my ordination, I've taken on the Amoghas City practice. And now I have props, and that was because of a dream. There were a couple of things, coincidence. When I was on holiday in California, I was driving with a friend along the coast and stopped in some sort of restaurant come shop, and I bought this. I didn't know anything about Amoghas City at the time, and I thought, well, I knew a Vajra was powerful, and I thought, well, I'll get my money's worth. I'll have a double, you know. And that turned out to be Amoghas City's, one of Amoghas City's symbols. Now, okay, I'll pick this up. And in case, for those of you who can't see, this is a picture of me before my ordination with Sangharakshita. Neither of us look that great, but anyway. So this dream I had, I was in New York at the time, visiting my family, and I dreamt that an eagle had landed on my head. And instead of being afraid of its talons sort of grabbing my scalp, I felt a thrill of pleasure going down my body. And I don't normally have very vivid dreams, but this was so vivid that I went to see Sangharakshita. I had already been invited on an ordination retreat. That means I was accepted in the ordination process. And I went to see him and asked him if there's anything that this suggests to him. And he said he couldn't think of anything. But he left the room, and I thought, oh, you know, is he bored? Is he fed up? But anyway, he came back holding this eagle, and he gave it to me. And then I asked if he would take a picture with me holding the eagle. So I have this. This is an important feature of my shrine. And the eagle, I learned subsequently through a series of researches that the eagle is identified with Amoghas City. Okay, back to the notes. Yes. So, the Abhaya Mudra is, for those who don't know, there's different hand positions in Buddhism. This is the hand position that says, do not be afraid. And it supposedly originated when the Buddha was set upon by his enemy. It's interesting to think of the Buddha having an enemy, but he had an enemy whose name was Devadatta, who set a mad elephant against the Buddha. And the Buddha's disciples heard about this and said, Lord, let us protect you. And he said, I don't need any protection. He wasn't afraid of death. He trusted his metta. And so he just stood there. The elephant charged towards him, and he just stood there. And the elephant slowed down, and came to a halt. And it made me think, I don't know if people have seen Crocodile Dundee. There's a scene in Crocodile Dundee where he does this to these fierce dogs. Do you remember? And they just stop. Anyway. But that's not a mudra as far as I know. And in my own life, the one thing that I left out, I left it out while I was reading it, was that I'm not afraid. Well, I'm going to take short for this. I'm not afraid of being mugged or raped. Now, because on two occasions I managed to talk my way out of a very, very difficult situation. And I could tell you briefly one situation. So, do I have time to tell? Yeah? I had just moved in across the road in this tall building, and there wasn't a security door at the time, and the entryway just went, oh, there's, Rich, it's your building, isn't it? The entryway just went straight to the elevators, and then the lifts, and then there's a flight of stairs, you know, so you just walked into the block, no door. That's how it was at that point. And I came home quite late at night on my own and just had the feeling somebody had been following me. And I turned around and I saw a young man was rubbing his crotch, you know, just coming towards me. And I think, you know, in all the films, oh, don't hurt me, you know. But I just turned around and went towards him. And so he didn't know what to do because it wasn't in his program, you know, that the person he was, I'm pretty sure, wanted to attack would sort of approach him rather than run away from him. And so he was quite off balance and said, what's the matter with you? I'm just here to visit friends. And he was afraid to wait for the lift, so he walked up the stairs. And I knew that he didn't want to visit friends and that if I took the lift, he would see what floor I was on. I would get, this is all such immediate calculations. And so I stood there, you know, waiting for him to come down, which I was sure he would. So he came down very gingerly down the stairs and he almost had a heart attack when he saw me still standing there. And he just ran, he just scurried off. So that was my mad elephant example, but there is a difference between me and the Buddha. I just, in case none of you, even despite my brain head. Now afterwards, I thought, oh my God, oh, get a load of this, ringing up friends. Oh, you know what just happened? Oh, I was so scared. Well, so change the situation. All right, here's the Buddha, stops the mad elephant. Can one imagine the Buddha saying, Ananda, get a load of this. You know what just happened? God, you know, that elephant, it really would have flattened me. You know, and if it didn't stop, boy, was my heart. Why can't one imagine the Buddha being like that? Why can't one imagine that? I even brought it up to someone who doesn't know anything about Buddhism, and I asked her if she could imagine that, and she couldn't imagine it either, because the Buddha represents something to us about openness, egolessness, fearlessness, unafraid of death, uncaring about any particular outcome in situations. And also, okay, another difference between me and the Buddha is that the Buddha's energy is totally integrated, so it wasn't as if he dealt with this, you know, oh, he mustered up his courage like I did, you know, and dealt with it skillfully, and then afterwards, oh my God. The Buddha didn't need to integrate his energy. His energy was always available in every circumstance, so there wasn't the leftover bits that he had to cope with afterwards. That's two differences between me and the Buddha. If you can think of any others, maybe you see me afterwards. Yeah, there were other examples of the Buddha pursuing a serial killer, Angulimala, and eventually Angulimala became one of his disciples. There are lots of stories like this of the Buddha being unafraid of death. And these stories haven't been passed down because the Buddha bragged about them, you know, to his mates or to his disciples, and they told it from generation to generation, that somehow these stories hold something about how one engages in the world in a fearless way. And the Buddha was unafraid of death. So what does that mean? I mean, the Buddha died. He was made of flesh and blood as we are. But he was not afraid to die because he no longer identified with his ego. And that's the component of ourselves that fears death and no longer existing. In fact, all fear can be boiled down to fear of dying, being fear of the unknown, or any other formulations of what we fear. What can help us? I mean, meditation helps because, as I described briefly before, what aspects are expressed when we're afraid? We're closed. We're locked into ourselves. We're not friendly. We're not generous. We're mean-minded. We're ugly. We're rigid. We're inflexible. All those things. So meditation helps us relax, helps us undo those kind of tight knots of fear and anxiety that accumulate with us, that are just part of us in our modern world. The Metta Bhavana helps us realize our interconnectedness, how we're all in the same boat, all living beings are in the same boat. There are techniques of dealing with really severe fear and panic attacks, but that's not my province right now. You know, I can't go into that right now. Okay. So the practice of Amoghasiddhi City, that Dhamma Dasan said that I built up quite a strong relationship with, almost to the point of a love affair. I feel I've been having a love affair with Amoghasiddhi City these last 7 years. And I think it was the most important gift that I received upon ordination, and it really, really has helped me progress spiritually. Excuse me, progress spiritually. So in conclusion, I want to say that Amoghasiddhi helped me convert into